You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This podcast is brought to you by Stella Artois. Make every moment unforgettable with Stella Artois. Whether at home with a cozy dinner or dining out, Stella Artois adds a touch of sophistication to any occasion. Stella Artois, a taste worth more. Enjoy responsibly. Welcome to What's Eric Eating, Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. On today's show, we'll talk about some news in the world of Houston restaurants, as well as our meals at a couple of new restaurants you may want to know more about. To do that, I'm joined by my co-host this week. He is a Houston hospitality veteran and a co-founder of the Houston Barbecue Festival. Michael Fulmer, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing this. Let's dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one, you know, we spent about an hour last week talking about the Michelin Guide's arrival in Houston and the 31 restaurants that they chose to include. Since we recorded that episode, that number has been reduced to 30 because Cao Ba, the Vietnamese restaurant in Montrose, was removed from the Bib Gourmand list after Michelin figured out that it had closed a couple of weeks ago. Michael, I don't want to overreact to this too much. You know, putting these lists together is hard. I remember maybe in 2018, you know, the Chronicle put together their list of the top 100 restaurants. They had Maba Pan Asian Diner as number 10. And in between when that list went to print and it came out, the restaurant closed. So if it's hard for the Chronicle that's local to get some of that, right? Like if the restaurant business moves a little faster sometimes than publications do, then it seems unreasonable to hold Michelin to a higher standard. But, you know, I do think that Cao Ba being removed kind of puts a spotlight on the fact that there's not a lot of Vietnamese food in the Michelin Guide. And I wondered if you thought that maybe that was, you know, from my perspective, that may be the most obvious thing that I'd like to see Michelin improve on in 2025.
We talked about I would reiterate that it's a good beginning. It's not, by no means is it comprehensive, but it's a really good start. They recognize barbecue for something more than just it's clearly not just about pandering to the locals. It's a recognized cuisine and a sense of excellence. And I think, you know, my hat's off to them on that. I ended that last podcast with I'd like to see them explore Asiatown more, and just there's so much there. For me, I think probably the most egregious would be the lack of sushi. I think we have some really high quality sushi, and not seeing Katarabata, not seeing, you know, Neo, even acknowledged as recommended or Bib Gourmand was to me just kind of almost absurd. But given how well they did with the first one, they get a pass from me on that. You know, we are going to talk about it, and I'm going to look forward to them adding that in and, you know, sort of correcting that omission, if you will, in the next guide, because they'll be here for at least another couple of years.
Right. I think that's it. And I think, you know, I've said this a few times. I'll say it again. You know, what occurs to me is that there's two things. This is the least they know about Houston. So the more time they spend here and the more they have opportunities to expand their reach, like that's all to the good. So they will learn more about the city. They'll get directed to more places, and that will improve the quality of their recommendations. And then the other thing is, I didn't appreciate the position that Michelin occupies, like in popular culture, right? Like Food and Wine Best New Chef, James Beard Award, those are important accomplishments, and the people who achieve them should be very proud of them. And people who read Culture Map and listen to podcasts like this one know how meaningful those accomplishments are. But if you don't do those things, but all you do is like watch TV and movies, then you've heard of Michelin because it gets referenced all the time. And you know that whatever you know about restaurants, you know that Michelin means a really, really good restaurant. And so just the amount of attention that has been paid in this last week since this announcement was made, and the coverage and the enthusiasm. I mean, we're not going to talk about our meal at Belly of the Beast, but we went to Belly of the Beast on a Wednesday, and it was as busy as I've ever seen it. They were doing like a Friday or a Saturday. Thomas Billy looked exhausted in a good way. And that's from being in the Michelin Guide, and the publicity surrounding it. So, you know, I understand people's reluctance in some way. I understand some of the ways that it's not complete, but I never would have just imagined that how broad a reach it has and what it means for the city to be included in that.
I'm not sure I understand you. Are you taking umbrage with the fact of their stature and the reaction, or are you?
No. I'm saying that, no, I'm impressed by the stature. I'm struck by the stature. I didn't appreciate the reach of the reputation and the name, and that seeing and that being included is going to change people's lives in a way that I maybe didn't anticipate.
I was misunderstanding your use of the verb appreciate. So that's just my bad. You know, Michelin, I mean, they were the first ones. They're the ones that started all this. And, you know, it was, of course, rather insular. It was more of a French thing and then expanded out through Europe. But their diligence, at really hitting these places and having a sense of integrity and maintaining that integrity is what has really kept their stature, I think, you know, to a great extent, and why people appreciate it. And, you know, they don't just hand out stars, like lollipops at the fair. It's a big deal. It's a very big deal. And as much as it's great to be honored by, you know, Food and Wine, by Bon Appetit, you know, to win Top Chef or any of these other nationally recognized, to some extent, you know, internationally recognized, you know, if you look at San Pellegrino in the top 50, I still think Michelin is at the top of the ladder on that. Now, what we have seen with all of these listicles and this incredible taxonomy of ratings is that, you know, new guys come onto the scene. You know, Michelin isn't the only game in town anymore. And I think we're starting to see, you know, them grow and kind of maneuver with that. They're not a staid, you know, static dinosaur. And I think that speaks well to them.
Well, and indeed, right? That's how you get 4 Texas barbecue joints with Michelin stars, because, you know, the idea of a counter service restaurant where you stand in line to order and that runs out of food at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, being worthy of a Michelin star is incompatible, right? In France, that would never fly. There are no French bistros that operate like that, where they would ever get that kind of recognition. But they understand the place that barbecue plays in Texas, and let's not overstate it, but they understand the PR value of recognizing barbecue restaurants with their top award, and that will draw more people to the website and the guide and download their app. So, you know, I think it's kind of a symbiotic thing where they want to show that they understand Texas, and Texans want to feel validated in our culinary traditions. And so, you know, selecting barbecue joints for stars makes sense in a way that it wouldn't in any other place in the world, really.
I'm going to agree. And also I would add that I don't think they're pandering to us. I think there is a certain validation because this is a recognized and valid cuisine. You know, this, it takes a lot of effort. you know, barbecue has a certain simplicity, but it's hard to do well. Like, I've eaten a lot of bad barbecue in my days, and the information's out there, and yet it still happens. Now, the bar, of course, is very high, but seeing them, like, you know, a lot of hubbub was made about the taco stand in Mexico City getting the star. There's the woman in Bangkok who I believe it's Bangkok who's going to actually retire soon, who got a star. And, you know, she has this like line that starts like 3 hours before she opens, and she does it all herself. And I think that's them really pointing to the fact that it's really about the food. It's about the culinary experience of what the food is, as opposed to just merely trappings of white tablecloths and the proper silverware and all that kind of accoutrement, you know, that sometimes Michelin just gets labeled with. And I think that speaks well to them, that ultimately they are looking at the food, at the cuisine, and at the experience of that. And that's, you know, Texas barbecue is a real thing, you know? And I think we'll see that, you know, we'll see them signifying and acknowledging other regional cuisines that have long histories and have high quality in other cities and other countries. And I look forward to seeing how that develops.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm with you, you know, that no recognition at all for Hori-san, either Kata Rabada or Katami, no recognition for Neo. Those were huge disappointments, and hopefully they correct that next year. All right, let's move on to topic number two. Allison Cook, the Houston Chronicle's restaurant critic, announced that she is leaving the paper effective November 27th. She has been there for 22 years. Allison Cook has worked at a number of places, but she won two James Beard Awards during her time at the Houston Press in 1995, and then she won another James Beard Award at the Chronicle in 2004. You know, obviously, I have a somewhat complicated relationship with Allison Cook professionally. So I got a lot of messages from people who wanted my take on it, but I'm going to let you go first. Say something nice about Allison Cook's impact on the Houston food scene.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a lunch meeting with someone in the barbecue world today, and the first thing they wanted to talk about was not the Michelin. It was about Allison Cook, you know, like what's happening, where's she going, you know. Her position and her effect on the food scene in not just Houston, but I think in Texas and overall, you know, it can't be overestimated. Well, it can be overestimated, but I think it's significant and deserves to be acknowledged. I think she has helped shape taste and interest in the food scene here and elsewhere for a long time. And it kind of goes back to, well, like, what is the job of a critic? You know, to me, it's having a sense of knowledge, but also having a sense of honesty and being rigorous about that. That are, you know, what happens with the public then is developing a relationship and understanding what her tastes are. Like, no one's going to agree with her 100%, as no one's going to agree with you 100%. But you come to understand what her tastes are, you know, and hopefully it's a very wide and varied one. I mean, I think back to the day there, I think there was a food critic here who, when I found out the amount of foods that she didn't eat and had allergies to, I was like, what are you even doing? And that's definitely not her. She was really kind of wide open. She was just voraciously curious, but she also had a take. She had a personality. She had a vision of that.
I think that's well said. I you know, part of the reason that I could predict with some confidence the number one restaurant in the Houston Chronicle's top 100 every year, or, you know, what restaurants were likely to be in the top 10 every year, is that as a reader, you could learn what her taste was and kind of the places that she would like. And so it, you know, you, there's a certain consistency there. So yeah, I think that's that does matter. You know, I once had a reader email me or message me or something and said, I hate every restaurant that you like. And I said, well, good, then just avoid those places. And when you see that I don't like something, that's probably for you.
I have a friend who does the same thing when I talk about movies. They're like, if I like it, they automatically know that, you know, they're not going to like it and they'll try something else. And like I said, once again, it goes to a certain consistency. You know, she was pretty well, I think she was well traveled and rather erudite, but not in a way that obfuscated, you know, that made her language or her vernacular problematic for her audience to understand. You know, I think she was able to express herself in a very creative way and a very distinctive way. And like I said, she had a take, she had a personality on this, and it goes forth decades, you know, and it, you know, there were certain, I remember there was a critic here in town who's no longer here. And I knew that if a place cost more than maybe $30, $35 a person, he was automatically, and he automatically was going to hate it, you know? And so I just dispelled him dining at any high-end places. And I didn't get the sense with her that she could go, and she could go to a taco stand or a barbecue place just as well as she could go to, you know, a five-star restaurant and have an opinion and have, you know, a take on it, you know, and have knowledge of it. And that speaks well of her.
Yeah. I mean, and she, you know, she had her blind spots, to be sure, you know, a tendency maybe sometimes to judge high-priced restaurants, especially from out of town, a little more harshly. If certain kinds of people were dining at those restaurants, you know, it would sort of get her hackles up, right? Like that she, you know, I think about the Steak 48 review where she, you know, said she took the steak home and even her dogs wouldn't eat it. You know, she could really twist the knife when she wanted to. But, you know, the thing that kind of comes down to it for me is that more than anything, she was Houston's ambassador to food media from around the country for many, many years. And she was our leading James Beard Award voter. And if someone from the New York Times or Esquire or Food and Wine was coming to town, they would ask her for recommendations. And so she was an early champion for people like Chris Shepherd and Hugo Ortega and Justin Yu and Anvil and a bunch of other places. And I don't think that we would have had the success in the Beard Awards for Justin and Chris and Hugo if she hadn't been in that position, if it had been someone else that didn't have that reputation. And so, you know, if nothing else, like her advocacy on behalf of the people that she respected helped elevate the Houston dining scene.
100%, 100%. And we may be at a crossroads where, you know, the era of the critic, you know, of a food writer who can have a, you know, a per diem that allows them to dine, you know, anonymously and to be able to express themselves without, you know, extreme oversight. You know, I'll be interested to see where that goes in the coming future. And of course, it's not lost on me that Pat Sharp, you know, of course, who's the longtime food critic of Texas Monthly and is also friends with Allison Cook, is also stepping down. You know, so we're at a crossroads here in Texas, and it'll be interesting to see if that void is filled or whether we enter into a new phenomena of reviewing, of critics, of understanding how we get information on new places, you know, other than, you know, the quick soundbite, the Instagram post or the TikTok. You know, I hope we do have a singular voice that comes forth who I can develop a relationship with again, because it's not just in food. That's important to me in all senses of culture, but particularly food, because that's the world that I live in.
Well, you know, I get all of my restaurant reviews from The Infatuation and our podcast comrade in arms, Chelsea Thomas. So I don't know what you're talking about. I feel perfectly sufficiently served.
Well, I get mine from the green sheet. It's actually in code. Little known fact.
No, I mean, the Chronicle hasn't really said anything about whether they intend to replace Allison. The article announcing her departure implied that she intends to keep working in some fashion. You know, I don't know in what format. The thought of an Allison Cook Substack makes me chuckle. Her cranking out a newsletter once or twice a week. I'll give her $5 a month for that if she decides to go that route. But, you know, whether the paper will commit the resources to bringing someone in who's qualified, who will take the time to learn the Houston food scene, review restaurants honestly and fairly, and polish up. You know, I think my take on the Chronicle's Top 100 is well documented, and I won't belabor the point, but you know, I don't think those are the 100 best restaurants in Houston. And I recognize that no list is going to make everybody happy, but there are some, just some blind spots that I'd like to see corrected. And a new voice with a fresh perspective, I think would be welcome if the Chronicle decides to commit to that.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you know, Jonathan Gold, who was certainly a titan of food criticism and so widely, you know, respected and revered. And when he passed, you know, for the LA Times, you know, they didn't even really replace. It was like they brought two people in.
And well, they tried to bring two people in, but that's now Bill Addison's job.
Yeah.
They brought two people in for about a year and now it's Bill Addison's job.
Right. And we're seeing, of course, in the New York Times, watching them to kind of a revolving door there. So we'll see what happens you know. I look forward to it, but I'm with you. I hope we get a strong and singular voice that I don't have, like I said, I don't have to necessarily agree with on majority of it. I just need to have a sense of honesty, rigorous honesty, integrity, and an ability to express themselves and a voracious curiosity. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I did get a couple text messages from people that were like, should have Allison on, you know, the exit interview, have her talk about her career. I said, I don't think that's very likely to happen, but if some friend of Allison's is listening to this and wants to encourage her to come on, she's welcome at any time. All right, let's move on to topic number three. Just briefly, I want to note that the Burger Joint and the Taco Stand are coming to the Memorial area to Gessner, just north of I-10 in early 2025. Michael, I've eaten with you at both the Burger Joint and the Taco Stand. They are regular spots on my rotation. So what do you think about this as an addition to the kind of Memorial City / Spring Branch area?
Spring Branch, I think we've talked about this before too, is like it really shows not just incredible growth, but still a lot of potential. You know, there's so much incredible ethnic food, and now we're starting to see higher level foods come in, you know, higher price points, more creative stuff. It's really exciting. And to say, you know, that's still an underserved area, it, you know, has a certain validity to it, you know, that they, you know, the Burger Joint, the Taco Stand have proven themselves, you know, with staying power. You know, there's some issues with line management and service initially. And I think they, for the most part, have gotten that worked out. You know, it'll never make like the list of the greatest taco or the best burger. But you know what? It's really solid. It's well-priced. They've got a drive-through. I have a doctor's office that's not too far from the Taco Stand, and I look forward to that doctor's visit, you know, on the few times I go there, because I can swing by the Taco Stand and get a lengua taco. You know, it's not, they don't just do, oh, fajitas and chicken and maybe barbacoa. You know, there's a wide expanse, and the quality of their flour as well as their corn tortillas are respectable. And so,
yeah. I mean, if I'm picking up an underground creamery order on a Monday night, odds are I'm going to the Taco Stand for dinner, because I can hit that drive through. I can get a barbacoa, I can get an asada, I can get their suadero, or I can get a quesadilla, whatever it is. You know, I'm going to spend less than $20 on dinner. It's efficient, it's tasty. And so, you know, I value it, and I'm happy that it's coming to Montrose next year, because it'll be that much easier for me to go there occasionally when I do want just a casual lunch or dinner.
I think it's also worth noting, and I'll stop shortly thereafter, is that it's also kind of hard to run a taco place because your price point, all the things that you have to support for that, when there's so many taco trucks, is particularly in the Spring Branch, you know, the Long Point area, that you can go get great, I mean, really good tacos for like $1.50, $2. And so you're paying a little bit more. But I think they do a good enough job to support that. And I'd like to see more of them.
Absolutely. All right. I'm going to say that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurants of the week. Stick around. Michael, for our restaurants of the week, I want to talk to you first about Ishtia. This is Chef David Skinner's Native American-inspired tasty menu concept that replaced Eculent down in Kima. You know, I've been to Eculent a few times over the years. I know you never had. So I guess just talk a little bit about, start at the beginning. I mean, what are your kind of thoughts on the overall experience, the room, the atmosphere, the vibe of Ishtia?
I wasn't sure what to expect. You know, I'd heard enough about Eculent, and I'm sorry that I never made it there. You know, not too many regrets in my life. That would be one of them. So it's like, what's this iteration? What is, you know, it seems like him really kind of leaning hard into what his heritage is and the incredible heritage of food that is. And for the most part, it was pretty damn good, I'd say. You know, starting off going upstairs to the bar, which was, to me, kind of strangely decorated in my mind. I felt like I was in a Hallmark Christmas movie. You know, it wasn't like what I thought a dining experience would begin with. But apart from the decor, the food was just, you know, I really enjoyed what we started off with, particularly like the beans and pozole, which is like there's something kind of, I mean, excuse me, the corn and pozole. Rather simple, but it was goddamn delicious. I just wish it had been a little bit warmer. That's all. And then, you know, moving down, the staff was pretty good about getting everybody in. You know, this is a tasting menu. This is done to everyone at the same time. Obviously, some people came late, but they got it. You know, they moved everyone down in a pretty smooth manner. And we got seated very, you know, in a very comfortable, appropriate way. And for the most part, the food flowed really well. And the quality of the food was sometimes as simple as we had a rice dish. And David talked about where he sourced the rice from this farm, I believe in Minnesota. And in this case,
yeah, from a native, specifically a native tribe in Minnesota, just to hammer home the point.
And he did very little to it. And it was, you know, sometimes I think the mark of a really good chef is when they get a great ingredient and they just get out of the way. You know, they don't try to bring a lot of technique or sauces or manipulations to it. They understand that the purity of that product and presenting it that way is the best way to go.
And so, Robert Del Grande used to talk about that, right? Get great ingredients and then don't ruin it.
Right. I mean, I used to work for Mark Cox, and I mean, sometimes he would have like 12 items on the dish, and you're just like, what's going on? And then sometimes he would do like a king crab with just some butter and a hearth, and it was just incredible. And he paid extra to get, you know, the fresh stuff. So, you know, I get both sides there. I would like to have heard of a little bit more in terms of like anecdotal stuff, more about the history. But that's just me and liking a story for each dish, because this is definitely, he's telling a story. Okay. There's a narrative to the whole meal and experience to the extent that it was cohesive. That can be kind of ironed out a little bit, because he does change the menu, but I would like to have heard more of that.
And there are dishes that have that story, right? Like early in the meal, you get that pot with the tepe beans and the bison in it. And he's like, this is reminiscent of a dish that if you had visited a Choctaw village or encampment,
right,
100 years ago, like they would always have a pot of beans cooking. And so this is my homage to that dish.
It was a form of greeting. Yeah. And I was just like, wow, it was so good.
And basic hospitality, right? That, you know, visitors are welcomed with food. And that's an idea that transcends cultures all over the world. So, you know, to see, okay, this is the native, or specifically the Choctaw version of this, like, okay, like I understand this. And yeah, I guess not every dish has that kind of story behind it, but the more that he can kind of expound on that, and the more that he can kind of tie you into, you know, the Native American culture that he's honoring with this menu, I think I agree with you. I think that's all to the good.
Yeah, like he's getting there, but I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more of that. The service flowed pretty well. I thought some of the portions were actually too large. You know, we got like this sort of massive strip, big piece of bison. You know, when you're going through that many courses, I get that you want to serve have a value perception and guess not to leave hungry. I mean, we've all heard about places where people went and had 15 courses and then went to Whataburger afterwards. This is definitely not that experience. If anything, I said that some of the courses were a little bit too big, and that's like obviously an easy fix and a nitpick. I think from a service standpoint, which I can certainly appreciate, I thought they flowed well. I thought the room for improvement was most notable in the wine service. The wine service needs to be, they need to up their game on that. They need to talk about, you know, what the varietal is, where it's from, and even list a vintage, not show a bottle and then tell me how it's going to taste right before I taste it. That's just, they really need to take that up a notch.
That is the one service aspect that I think there's the most room for improvement on, right? Don't tell me what flavors I'm going to get from the wine. Like, let me taste it and get the flavors from it. Do tell me where it's from. And maybe even a little bit about like why you picked it, you know, or, you know, right. And they were all Italian wines, which I thought was maybe a little strange. Like we had an Italian sparkling wine to start and then I guess a French wine with the red meat at the very end, but you know, just a little more thought into the beverage program would enhance the experience.
I'm not even sure if they even mentioned what the grape varietal is, which is like first thing you want to do. I tried the non-alcoholic tasting, which was, you know, okay, I get it. It's non-alcoholic wine, but yeah, it was just all kind of sweet.
Yeah, you took one sip of all of them and were like, no, I'm good. Okay, I'm not drinking that.
And I don't know if there is a good non-alcoholic wine. I think they would probably be better served to have like a sort of mocktail program like that, but that's my take on that. The desserts were good, you know, not life changing, not, you know, is this, you know, we talked about when we were leaving, like, is this a Michelin starred place yet? And I don't, the answer to, for me is it's not yet. I think we need to get more of the narrative in there. I think they need to up their game on the wine service, and some of the dishes can be tightened up, but you know what, is it on its way? Yes. Is David clearly a talented chef? Does he have a good crew? Yes, he does. You know, and it's interesting that it's, you know, it's all the way out in Clear Lake, you know, in the middle. Like, I wonder, and I ask you this, like, how do you think that place would do if it was put in the smack center of like the Houston dining epicenter, you know, the Heights, Montrose, Midtown area? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I've wondered about that. I mean, you know, all the way out in Kima, from an inner loop perspective, but I know that the people who live in that Bay Area are very proud that it's there, and they've supported him for many years and continue to support him. So, and, you know, just judging by, you know, who we were sitting with, you know, the couple next to us was from Katy. They're celebrating an anniversary. There was a group of four people at the far end of the bar who had, you know, had a driver and come in from, you know, somewhere in like the West Yuma, Bel Air, I think. Yeah, yeah. Bel Air. Right. So, you know, I think it's obviously a sufficient draw to the rest of Houston. I think, you know, if it were inside the loop, the service would be different because it would be easier to hire people with more experience to work there. And so that aspect might be enhanced. But I, in terms of the quality of the food and the cooking and all of that, I think Inner Loopers would respond very favorably to it. And, you know, you sort of mentioned Michelin, and I've been getting DMs, messages all weekend from people who were like, oh, I want to see him in the Michelin guide, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And I'm with you. I don't know that it's quite there yet, but the very best dishes, that diver scallop that he uses as a platform for the three sisters, the Native American corn beans and squash that are, you know, kind of in that if it grows together, it goes together right. Mindset, you know, the wild rice dish with the smoked trout and really even the cook on the strip and the bison. You know, I think those dishes are the kind of dishes that would earn him a place in the Michelin guide. It's just tightening up some of the little things, right? That kind of throwaway salmon tart that I don't know that it really, you know, added anything to our meal. Just give me the parsnip tart. Like, I only need one tart, you know, the some of the gimmicky, like the tweel on the rabbit roulade. Like, I don't really know that enhanced anything, or the kind of gimmicky coral snake colored pasta. It's eye catching to be sure, but was that broth like the best chicken broth I've ever had? Like, no, it wasn't really. So,
you know, some of the presentations are, I mean, this is the guy who has segued from Eculent, which was, you know, really about the wow factor with presentations. And I don't think that just goes away. Like you said, the diver scallop, the way it was presented, you know, the torched what was it that we had? There were some things that they lit at the table also. There was definitely, you know, a show aspect to that, and that's okay.
Right. The venison cheek presented in the plant, right? Like that stuff is what I value from David Skinner's food, right? I want that experience.
Yeah. And when we're seeing Houston kind of move away from tasting menus and I would, you know, not including omakase, everything's omakase, is that I'm actually happy to see this kind of tasting menu out there. I want to see not just the creativity, but his ambition and leaning into his heritage, you know, is fantastic. You know, we know he's gotten a strong relationship with Ben Sean and, you know, with Grant, with Graham over at Street to Kitchen, you know, and what they're doing. And, you know, he's clearly a wildly curious person. You know, if you follow his social media, you see how well he travels and, you know, how he connects with cuisines in different places. And so, like, when you say it's not quite there yet, when we talk about Michelin, yeah, but I think he's on the track.
I think that's right. And I think he's got some time to get it dialed in. And I think the only reason that Ishtia wasn't in the guide at all is that it's just simply too new, right? It only opened this summer. And we're pretty sure that the inspectors were in Houston prior to that, you know, maybe as early as February or March. So they probably went to Eculent and had an experience. And then they went back to Ishtia and were like, oh, it's a new restaurant. Like we need to give this some time to let it settle in a little bit. So, you know, I do think that we'll see it in some context and he has time to get things dialed in. And we were there and he said he's got plans to upgrade the meat offerings and enhance the way they're presented. He used the word meat trolley. So I don't quite know what to expect from a meat trolley, but that makes me want to go back for sure. And you know, that is our standard. I mean, we always talk about that. Having had that experience, would you go back? Would you recommend other people go?
I would give it a recommendation. I would go back when the menu changes, like when the meat trolley comes out. Sign me up. Let me know and we'll go.
Absolutely. All right. And then just briefly, I want to talk to you about Emma Jane. This is the new tea house from the Kirby Group at the Harlow District, which is the property, the former Vincent Sandino's property that's now home to Gautami and Verde Garden and La Grilla. This is kind of on the backside of all that. It's two little houses right next to each other. We went, as I said, they're doing lunch, they're doing dinner, but we only went for tea. And so I don't think we have to spend too much time on this, but what did you think of our tea, our lovely little tea at Emma Jane?
I love it the way you say that. You know what? I was really impressed. I was kind of had my arms folded with, okay, they're going to do some kind of facsimile of, you know, high tea at some like, you know, high Flouten, you know, London hotel. And you know what? They're doing their thing. And let me tell you, the teacups, the teapots, the flatware, it's all really nice, you know, and it doesn't just look good. It's really functional. And the qualities of the teas were excellent. I mean, we tried two of them and they were brewed at the proper temperature, you know, enough time with that. The quality was definitely there. I didn't have a chance to try the menu, which is, now that I've looked at it, quite extensive, actually. It was just about having the tarts and the scones, the biscuits and the little sandwiches. And they were spot on. You know, the scones had great texture to them. They weren't dry. The biscuits it was different enough. They clearly were different on how they did that. It was more of an English style scone. You know, in America, they tend to, you know, add things into the scones like dried fruits or even savory things. Here was more about, oh, we're going to bring you the clotted cream. We're going to bring you a high quality jam next to it and you can enjoy it that way or just by itself. And they were really good. You know, it's a very comfortable place. It's the kind of place like, you know, you could take a date or go with a family member. You know, it's very comfortable. They have some chairs that are a little low and they're going to have to figure that out. But, you know, like they have nice champagnes and wines by the glass and the service there was really good.
Yeah, we got a very enhanced level of attentive service from the GM, Neil, and our server. But you know, I was looking around the dining room. I think everybody feels pretty well taken care of. And I agree with you. you know, the quality of the pastries. There was a little chocolate cake with a little bit of coffee in it that I really enjoyed. I thought the texture on the biscuit and the scone were, you know, what I consistent with my expectations. And you know, the little cucumber sandwich, like it wouldn't be tea without cucumber sandwiches. So I was impressed by the quality of the food. It winds up being like a pretty satisfying, you know, it's somewhere between a snack and a meal, you know, in terms of the quantity of food that you eat. And then, you know, I agree with you. I mean, the teas were very tasty. They were brewed correctly. And that, you know, colorful china pattern that they're using for the teapots and the teacups adds a sense of occasion to it, kind of justifies that, you know, I think it's $65 a person or whatever it is. You know, for that kind of money, you want it to be an experience because, you know, all in, you know, tax and tip, you're going to be at, you know, 150, $170. So I think what they're offering is compelling. And I really enjoyed it. And I would say that I will go back. I've already gone back because a friend of mine saw my pictures and was like, I want to try that. Let's go. So I did.
Yeah, I would completely go back. Like, and just for the sake of knowledge, it was like, I'm not really much of a tea drinker anymore. When I lived up north, I was. It was more of a cold weather thing. But after this experience, I kind of realized how much I missed drinking a quality tea and having that kind of experience there. And so even though that's more of a cool or cold weather, we don't really have cold weather, but cool weather event for me. I could see going back there, you know, all throughout the year, like I said, on a date or taking a family member or just wanting to have that kind of comfortable experience and what high tea should be, which is enjoying the tea and having enough food to get you through a different meal, you know. So would I go back? Yes. Did I think it was a good value for that amount? I do. I actually do.
All right, Michael, I'm going to say that does it for the restaurants of the week. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Join me on Thursday when my guests will be Stephanie Velasquez and Nicholas Vera from Emma and Popolo Taqueria.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.